Hi, my name is Johnny Gartner, and thank you so much for joining me for this week's episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. At Cedar 60, our mission is to engage with culture and politics from the distinctive lens of the gospel, and today I am excited to have Dr. Daniel DeWitt join me to discuss politics, worldview, and apologetics. Dr. DeWitt, thank you so much for joining us
today. My pleasure. Yeah.
So if you could first kind of introduce yourself to the viewers, talk a little bit about what you do here at Cedarville, as well as also what brought you here to Cedarville before you were teaching here.
So my role at Cedarville is as a faculty member, so I teach a lot of classes in the Bible minor, and I also lead a Center for Apologetics, which we do a weekly coffee meeting where students just hang out. We call it Mere Caffeination. We do a monthly seminar, so we've interviewed people in the past, like Erica Harold, who's involved in Illinois politics and is a Harvard law grad and former Miss America. Interviewed Christian artists like KB, Christian hip-hop artists, and others, and often will bring people to campus when it works out. Love my role here. Love what I get to do. My wife and I have been married for 20 years. We have four kids, Isaiah, Micah, Josiah, and then a girl, Adeline Joy.
That's so cool. What sparked your interest in talking about these kinds of things? I think, you know, a lot of people have Christians, I should say, should have an interest in the Bible and, you know, sharing that with other people. But what kind of like sparked your interest? Like, this is what I want to do for a career.
It was kind of, I like to tell people I'm a creative who accidentally became an academic. And so it was never my plan. I had a mentor who was just a great driven guy. Mm-hmm. He played football at West Point Academy, was diagnosed with cancer in his first semester there. So was received a medical discharge and ended up doing a lot of academics. Mm-hmm. So it kind of wasn't his plan either. And in working for him, he was just always pressing me to get another degree. Like, great, you're done. Get another degree. And so, but throughout my academic career, I always have gravitated towards communications, marketing, public relations. At my last school, I ran the creative team and PR office for a few years. And so that's kind of, I'm a weird hybrid of academics and writing and creative stuff. Uh-huh. And so I think that comes out in my classes. But in terms of worldview and apologetics, a lot of that is born out of my own wrestling with how I make sense of my own lived experience and making sense of my faith in light of disappointments in life and whatever. So I was in my freshman year of college. My parents were in the middle of a divorce. And the college I went to was a very fundamentalist Bible college and was not a good fit. And it really made me wrestle with, you know, I don't believe what the way they talk about faith. And so I ended up transferring out a year later. And the very first class I took at this new Christian college was on apologetics. And I really didn't take it for anybody else. I really took it just for my own soul. And so out of that, I've had a desire just to keep studying and thinking about how do you give a winsome articulation of what Christians believe that's respectful of other people. Mm-hmm. So I'm for diversity if we truly mean diversity. Like you could have a different opinion, I could have a different opinion on really important issues, but we could still be friends. Mm-hmm. And so for me, apologetics is not about battling other people. I don't see people as enemies. I think that what we need to do is have a winsome articulation of what we believe. And at the end of the day, let the best arguments win out. And we should, above all things, seek to make the gospel attractive because it is. It's beautiful. And so for me, that's kind of how I approach these things, but it really came out of my own spiritual journey.
You've kind of already addressed this, but 1 Peter 3:15, you know, says provide a reasonable defense for the faith that is within you. And I, at Cedarville, we talk about that a lot. You know, we talk about that in a lot of the different studies we are, not just in biblical studies. But and you've already kind of said why this is important. But, you know, not just from a political sense, but why is it important? Why does Peter, it's included in 1 Peter, why is it so important for Christians that we do that?
Yeah, I think for Peter, you know, really the context there is kind of persecution. Mm. You know, people are being asked. It's not, you know, across a coffee table. It's probably more an interrogation. Mm. And so I think that's helpful to keep in mind in terms of the context that the, you know, the first century Christians were facing. But in our day, we need to be ready to when someone says, why do you believe that? The Greek word apologia is where we get the term apologetics from. And apologetics has been used in numerous disciplines. I mean, for example, you know, when Socrates gave a defense for why he didn't believe in all the Greek gods, and they said, you're an atheist. And he oddly enough said, no, I actually only believe there's one God, which was so radical for, you know, his role as a Greek philosopher, because they believed in many gods. So he was monotheistic, which is interesting. But long story short, his defense is called an apology, right? So it's important that Christians know what we believe, why we believe it. But then Peter says the way we should do that is with gentleness. And so there's a certain way that we give an answer. And I'm afraid that sometimes in the political realm that people are have so been fed a steady diet of sound bites and arguments that are seeking to crush an opponent or to ridicule a particular group of people. And I don't think that that's what Christian apologetics should look like. So we should be involved in politics because what we believe has real consequences in the world. But we need to do it in a way that is kind, that it is winsome, and hopefully that people will listen and think, I don't know that I agree with you, but man, I kind of wish that was true.
Yeah. I think you have made a lot of really good points there. And I think politics of itself is kind of apologetics because you're, you know, arguing from a conviction that you think that a certain policy is better for the country than another. But what undergirds Christian apologetics is this basic belief in a specific worldview. So if you could kind of talk about why it's important to have a foundation in the Bible, in the inherent truth of the Bible, so that when we go out into the world and we start having these apologetic conversations with people, we can do so in the winsome way you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the one example, just think about the American history. And so our founding father said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I believe, I agree with that value 100% and pray that I would be willing to even die for that, that conviction that people are equal. And they're endowed with certain rights, you know. But the problem with framing it the way that some of our founders did is it really was an accommodation between this Judeo-Christian worldview that's influenced by a belief that God exists and that he's revealed himself, and it's an accommodation to deism, which is a belief that God exists, but he hasn't revealed himself.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to make an argument that could be acceptable to both, it would have to be something like, these are self-evident truths. Rather than they're revealed to us. And I think that there's a certain limitation to what we might call natural law arguments or arguments that would kind of arise out of human experience, is that we can differ in our perspectives. And probably the most self-evident thing about human history is our inequality. I mean, even among our founding fathers, the way they treated Native Americans, the way they treated African Americans, they demonstrated that it was actually not self-evident to them that we were created equal. And if you were to put that on a global scale, the statement that all men are created equal around the world, in some places that would be acceptable if you actually meant men. All men are created equal. So therefore, women could be excluded from that. Or if you go to places where there's a caste system, even if it's only informal, if it's not formally enforced, it would be laughable to say it's self-evident all people are created equal. And so my point with that would be this. If we really want to have staying power for certain human rights and human values, it takes a deeper foundation. And that's why if you read the sermon transcripts of Martin Luther King Jr., if you read the arguments of William Wilberforce, of course, we have a school 4 miles from here, the first HBCU in North America, named after the great British abolitionist Wilberforce. If you read their strongest and most compelling arguments, they weren't saying this is self-evident. They were rooting their arguments in something transcendent, in something that God had revealed. They were rooting their arguments in Scripture. And I think that that just that very fundamental way that we interact with each other, are you equal? Do you have worth? Do you have intrinsic worth? That needs a foundation strong enough that it could actually stand up to whatever the cultural questions are of the day. And I think our founding fathers illustrate, we can't get that from self-evidential arguments. I get where they came from with that. We need something bigger, and Scripture provides that.
What is the other aspect of politics that's not you know, a politician standing in front of the country giving a speech about a certain policy, but a politician working to change legislation on something and, you know, interacting with his coworkers. I think I mentioned this earlier, but in some ways, to me, politics is just another career field. Mm-hmm. And so how can we take that understanding and take our understanding of apologetics and apply a biblical worldview to that?
Yeah, I was interviewed shortly after I moved here by the Dayton Business Journal, mm-hmm. and they had asked me to speak about Christianity in the workplace. And I think the journalist I spoke with was a bit surprised when I said, I don't think that the Christian's goal should be evangelism in the workplace. And by that, I mean, I don't think that a Christian is honoring God by not doing what they're paid to do.
Yeah.
And so I think the best thing they could do is work really hard, be committed, you know, show up early, stay late, be the most dependable person there, and let that be a form of their way of showing what they believe, yeah. how it's lived out. And I think politics would be similar to that, that we do all things with our hearts, you know, a wholehearted commitment as unto the Lord, not just trying to please our supervisor who's watching us, but even when they're not watching, to be diligent. Christians, I think, should be the hardest working, kindest people to work with. And then out of that, as you have opportunity, why do you do this? Why do you believe that? I think in that kind of context, and so instead of me coming in preaching or saying the way I'm going to serve God as a politician is to start a Bible study with other Christian politicians, well, that may have a place. I think it'd be better for you to just say, I'm going to be a really good politician who cares for people and tries to pass legislation or, you know, be a part of the process that benefits human flourishing. And out of that, you have these meaningful relationships and you have a good reputation. Mm-hmm. And I think out of that, interpersonally, in conversations, you could talk about your faith. But let that come at a later point when you've earned the right to be heard.
Yeah. I think I love C.S. Lewis, as I know you do, and so I was looking up quotes from C.S. Lewis, and he once said that almost all crimes of Christian history have come about when religion is confused with politics. Mm-hmm. So you've kind of mentioned that, you know, you don't want people going into politics thinking they're going to somehow save every human being by their work as a politician or in Congress or whatever aspect of politics they're working in. But can you also talk about, you know, how we as individuals who have a significant part to play in the political system in America can engage with politics from a biblical worldview with, you know, this vision of apologetics in mind?
Well, I would say a starting point would be, you know, sometimes politicians will, even Christian conservative politicians will make their point by making fun of another group. And so to recognize our shared humanity, that no one wakes up and says, you know, I want to espouse the stupidest ideology I could possibly find, right? So everybody has come to her beliefs or his beliefs through a journey, and they have what seems to them compelling reasons to hold it. And so I think to begin with, we're going to engage in a process that's going to require some level of polemics, of pointing out where we disagree. But I think that Christians should always be seeking to build bridges where we have shared values, even if it's across the aisle. And in a day that's so bifurcated, so divided, that's hard to do. But Christians should lead the way on that. And I think Christians should model what it really looks like to have diversity, to where we have ideological diversity and every other kind of diversity, not that's founded on compromise, but one that's actually founded on mutual care and respect. And so in that way, a Christian can try to advance values that they care deeply about. But I think that we just have to be cautious. At the end of the day, we want to point people to something that we think is beautiful and glorious and can actually fill this missing part of their soul. As Pascal said, there's a vacuum in the human heart. And so I think as we engage in that, to begin with our shared humanity and then to find ways, because at the end of the day, there is legislation that needs to be passed that's reflective of Christian values, but to do it in such a way that we're also reaching the people that we're passing in the hallways as we're trying to get this law passed.
I think moderation is a scary word these days because people don't want to be called a moderate because they want to stand for something. But there's a difference between ideologically moderate and being moderate and how you interact with people and not attacking people. Is there any advice you would give our listeners in the day-to-day? I'm having a conversation with someone about why I believe what I believe that can make it easier and can kind of apply some of these things that you've been talking about.
I think the biggest piece of advice I would give someone is be really kind and be really curious. And so if you sincerely care about others and you just want to know, like, people are fascinating. James Sire, who was a Christian philosopher, wrote this book called The Universe Next Door. And he was talking about your neighbors, this whole universe, right? And you could be separated in terms of what you believe by this massive chasm. I mean, they could believe something radically different than you. And you might think they're crazy and they think you're crazy. But how fascinating is it to explore an entire universe, right? So people are fascinating, what makes them tick. And if you're curious about them and you're interested in them, I think it's inevitable that they're going to be interested in you. And so sometimes when we go out so eager to share what we believe, we just want to talk. We're primarily committed to monologuing. And so be curious, really care about people. And then out of that, I think you get this dialogue. And a dialogue is where you're going to have the most meaningful impact. And so for Christians, sometimes, even with politics, we think, how can I make this national or even international difference? And we miss the real opportunity to make a local difference. Yeah. And so Christians sometimes can get blinded by national politics, and they miss, like, actually voting for local politics. Mm-hmm. And I would apply that to your Christian witness. You could think, I want to make this massive impact for my faith. And I would encourage you, that may look like you talking to your barista, or you crossing the street to talk to your neighbor. So don't miss the big deal that's right in front of you because you're looking for something that's more national or international.
Do you have any resources that you would suggest to kind of equip us as we prepare for this, you know, books to read, and also in our quiet times and in our study of the Bible, like, what example does Jesus even provide about how to do that effectively?
Oh, wow. So I'll give a book, and then I'll say something about, I think, Jesus's, one of the things that most affects me looking at the life of Jesus. So I mentioned James Sire,
right,
who's this author. He's passed away a couple of years ago. Okay. But his book, The Universe Next Door, is great.
Okay.
And so he asked 8 questions that you could ask people, and he describes them. And there are 8 questions to get at why they hold their view of the world. And so then he goes through 8 different worldviews and asks those questions. And James Sire was the kind of guy that regularly had coffee with people who were atheist, agnostic, Eastern religions, very different from him. And he had these really long-term friendships that modeled what I think is not only possible, but I think is necessary if we're going to really make an impact in an increasingly pluralistic society. What does it look like to live in this world, as Jesus said, to be in the world but not of it, so that we're able to offer something meaningful to people who aren't going to show up at our church or at our Bible study? Now, as it relates to Jesus, Jesus had the strongest words of condemnation, not for what we would consider the pagans of the day, but for religious leaders. And so much of his criticism was hurled at people who claimed to know God, didn't care about others, and were primarily concerned about heaping burdens upon them, rather than giving this wonderful, glorious image of a God who is waiting to forgive them, as the prodigal, the story of the prodigal son. And so I would say, really immerse yourself in the way of Jesus as you read it in the Gospels and ask yourself the question. This may sound cheesy, but it goes back to WWJD, you know, the t-shirts and bracelets from back in the day. How would Jesus live in the world? And ask that of politics, ask that of being a faithful citizen, ask that of whatever your job is. And I think the more we ask that question, the more we're going to be driven to really love people like Jesus did. Mm. And if you look at the life of Jesus, people were drawn to him. And I think as we look more like Jesus, we're going to have those kind of opportunities as well.
there's some aspects of childhood that have importance no matter how old you are in life. So I think we've talked about the fact that the public square is unique in that it has a very broad influence. But in some ways, it's no different than, you know, any other aspect of life where we're not called to proselytize necessarily, but we are called to reflect the gospel and the life of Jesus and how we interact with people. And so you've provided some really great insights in how to do that applicably, both, you know, in the public square, but also just as we engage with it as individuals. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
For the last 60 seconds, if there's anything that we didn't cover or anything that you have on your heart, you are more than likely to go for that right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to do this. I would say read Colossians 4. The Apostle Paul in the opening verses of that chapter says, be watchful in prayer. Pray that we would have an open door for the word. So Paul's saying, pray that we would have an opportunity to speak about our convictions. And then he says to make the most of your time with outsiders. And I think that's such a really convicting thought. We're frivolous with our time often with people who don't know what we believe or don't care, or maybe they're offended. And Paul says, make the most of that time. And he says, always season your words with salt, which is so interesting, so that you might know how you can answer every person. And so the way that we know how to answer people like Peter commands is by making the most of our opportunities and being very careful with our words in political discourse, in kind of becoming a talking head, which often we kind of gravitate to. How do we get to be the one who people want to listen to us? It's easy for us to be careless with our opportunities and careless with our words. So my last encouragement is, be careful with your time and be careful with your words.
That is so fantastic. I think when politics come into a conversation, it's really easy to let your passion for a topic, you know, cloud your judgment and your reason on, you know, this is more than just me arguing about a persuasion about a certain policy perspective, but my reputation as a Christian is also on the line here. And so that's something that's really important to think about. So
absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Dr. DeWitt. We really appreciate this opportunity to have this really great conversation. So we really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the Cedar 60 podcast. We hope you'll make sure to subscribe on social media and all major podcast platforms. And we hope you'll join us next time. Thanks so much.